The Achaemenid Empire lasted 208 years. The Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great lasted 231. The Roman Republic lasted 233. Romanov-Russia lasted 234. Today, the United States of America is 244 years old. What happens next? Where do we go from here? What do we build out of the ashes? Hello, I'm Kenaz Filan, and these are Notes from the End of Time.
Hello, I'm Kenaz Filan. Welcome to Notes from the End of Time. This is our sixth episode. I'm just getting back from a vacation. I spent several days in the lovely state of Maine with my friends Tom and Dana Kaczynski and several other friends of mine, and I have a lot to talk about today. Let's start with a nice non-controversial topic. I have said on several occasions that I was willing not only to die for my family and my faith, but I was willing, under extreme circumstances, to kill for them. And today I thought we could go into some more detail about when is it acceptable for me as a Roman Catholic, you know, for other people as Christians, to kill for your family or for your faith. I understand this is kind of an uncomfortable topic with people. Nobody likes to talk about violence, and of course, religious violence is the worst thing ever. The Catholics are horrible crusaders who started the Inquisition. But sometimes you have to defend yourself, and some people won't take nothing less than killing to be discouraged from doing wrong. And because of this fact, we've been forced to come up with what's become best known as the just war theory. The general outline of what is considered just war theory in the West was started by a man named St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas gave us the jus ad bellum, you know, the causes for a just war. What could a Christian do morally in a war, and what were the circumstances under which it was moral to go to war? Let's start with Thomas Aquinas' definition of justice. For St. Thomas, justice was a moral virtue. It perfected the faculty of will. It was intellect disposing the will in such a way that a person was set in order, not only in himself, but also in regard to another. Justice was the moral virtue which allowed us to live among other people, which forced us to consider not only our own needs and wants, but the needs and wants of the community. It was our sense of fairness that led us to help the weak rather than taking advantage of them. It led us to spare an enemy rather than slaughtering him. Justice was the capacity to know when to use force, when to defend a principle, when to defend your home or your family. It was the principle that allowed us to ascertain just how much force was necessary. It was the force that allowed for the capacity of mercy. And mercy is a very important thing here. I might use the Latin definition, clementia. That's a very complicated word. One definition would be mercy exercised appropriately. Mercy is taking all circumstances into account, allowing for other factors that may have led this person to do evil, mitigating circumstances, and thereby acting toward the most moral outcome. And here we come to another conundrum. What is the most moral outcome? And now let's look at St. Thomas's definition of morality. And to get into that, this you will see is getting pretty complicated. Thomas believed the soul had different powers. We have apprehensive powers. Those are powers that produce knowledge. For him, those would have been our senses and our intellect. They produce knowledge. Then we have the appetitive powers of the soul. Those are powers that incline us to a certain goal, to a certain end, in light of how they're apprehended by our senses or by our intellect as desirable or undesirable. For example, you smell food and you're hungry. Your mouth starts watering and you want to seek out food. That desire is part of, you have a will to seek out food. Now, for St. Thomas, the human will was an appetitive power. It was an appetite. It's what drives us to be or act in such way as our intellect presents as desirable. Our senses gave us all that sense of food, and now we want to get food, and so we will ourselves to go to the refrigerator and get a sandwich. And will is involved with all of our other passions, too. We're angry, and our desire is to lash out at the first immediate object. And now, we understand that's a bad idea. That's the leading cause of domestic abuse, assault. Lots of violence has happened because somebody got angry and committed violence. We understand that we have a sexual urge, but we need to constrain that. Otherwise, we could be guilty of crimes like rape. You could call these loosely passions. And for St. Thomas Aquinas, the human will was a passion. For Aleister Crowley said, "Thou hast no right but to do thy will, and do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." Aquinas more wisely recognized that the human will needed to be guided and controlled. It needed to follow some higher order, lest we revert to barbarism and ultimately to a wholly carnal and animal nature. And where Crowley said, "Strike hard and low, and to hell with them, master," St. Thomas saw that the will needed to be directed to the good as defined by reason, and that was justice. Justice was intellect disposing the will such that a person is set in order not only in himself, but also in regard to another. Unlike most of the people who are screaming, "No justice, no peace," today, St. Thomas Aquinas spent a great deal of time thinking about justice. His ideas on the virtues come straight out of Aristotle, and you can find reflections of his ideas on justice in these meditations of the great Stoic Marcus Aurelius, who said, "If I remember then that I am part of such a whole, I shall be well contented with all that comes to pass, and in so far as I am bound by a tie of kinship to other parts of the same nature as myself, I shall never act against the common interest, but rather I shall take proper account of my fellows, and direct every impulse to the common benefit, and turn it away from anything that runs counter to that benefit. And when this is duly accomplished, my life must necessarily follow a happy course, just as you observe that any citizen's life proceeds happily on its course when he makes his way through it, performing actions which benefit his fellow citizens, and he welcomes whatever his city assigns to him." Aquinas saw justice as one of three moral virtues. The other one was temperance, control of our passions, love, hate, anger, gluttony, our sloth, our desire for comfort over what needs to be done if it's difficult, and fortitude, which is our ability to withstand hardships and setbacks in order to do what is right. All three of these were necessary for an individual to live a moral life. And one of the first rules of a jus ad bellum, of a just war, is that it's called by a legitimate authority. And what is a legitimate authority? In my country, America, right now, there's a significant chunk of our population that does not accept Donald Trump as our legitimately elected president. After the votes are tallied in the November 2020 election, I fully expect that half the country is going to be convinced that they were cheated and that whoever takes the office only got in through fraud or chicanery. I'm not entirely sure we have a legitimately elected authority in the United States right now. That being said, Catholics and Christians in general have always been enjoined to follow the laws of the state insofar as they did not contradict the teachings of the Bible, of Christ, or of the Church. There's a long tradition of Christian social disobedience. Sometimes it got us thrown to the lions, it got us shot, as it did for Archbishop Romero in El Salvador. There is certainly a long precedent of Christians disobeying what they considered to be unchristian or unscriptural commands on moral grounds. There's also a long tradition of Christians fighting to defend their heritage, fighting to defend their churches, and killing people who attack their churches and their faith. And a just war also demands a just cause. Some just causes would include self-defense, the citizens' lives, their livelihoods, and their way of life. Or more generally speaking, as according to Eric Patterson in his November 30, 2016 article, Just War Theory and Terrorism, the cause is likely just if it rights a past wrong, punishes wrongdoers, or prevents further wrong. You also have to consider the right intent. For Cicero, for Augustine, for a lot of thinkers since, war could only be waged for the end, with the only just end of a just war would be peace. Are your actions being done in the cause of peace? Are you committing violent acts for the purposes of order and justice, or are you doing them because you're angry and you're acting out of hatred and revenge? You have to consider whether your actions will make a difference in the real world. Did Robert Bowers make a great difference in the real world when he shot up the Tree of Life synagogue? Have the BLM protests made America a less racist place or a safer place? And if you answer, we don't want to make it safe, we want you to make you feel uncomfortable, well then, my friend, what you're telling me is you've declared war against me. And that, of course, brings us to our next question. What would be a proportionate response to that act of war? What am I allowed to do to defend myself against people who say they want me and my family dead, people who attack my church, who tear down our statues, who tear down our monuments, who tear down our history? What am I morally allowed to do? And what's more, what am I morally obligated to do to defend my tradition, my family, my heritage, and my principles? Because of my Catholic principles, I am obligated to see every human life as sacred from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death. The Catholic Church allows us, as I said, to fight in a war and to maim or kill an opponent if it becomes absolutely necessary, but it specifically forbids me from harming an innocent. It's always been understood that there will be civilian casualties in a war. It's been understood that innocents die in war. That's one of the reasons why we are obligated as Catholics to pray for an end to war and to work toward creating a more just society, and why we're obligated to treat war as an absolute last resort and to only be done after all other means of rectifying the situation have been exhausted. I'm obligated to negotiate, and I want to negotiate with people of goodwill, regardless of race, ethnicity, skin color. I don't care. So long as we can work together toward a peaceful solution, I can and will work with any honest person toward that peaceful solution. But everybody's saying no justice, no peace. There can be no peaceful solution unless we can work together toward a just solution. While the BLM and Antifa protesters out in the street disagree with me and I with them on any number of issues, there's one point on which we strongly agree. We both agree that American society of 2020, as it is fundamentally corrupt and needs a radical restructuring. To that end, and in the interest of starting a dialogue, I invite any listener who considers himself a supporter of BLM, Antifa, radical left, communist, Marxist. I am offering you a dialogue, and I begin with these questions. What is your end goal in all of these protests? What do you hope to accomplish by the riots, by the protests, by the violent actions, by burning police precincts? What do you see coming out of this? If you're just acting out of anger, I'm not saying your anger isn't justified or saying that there aren't real reasons and real injustices behind your anger, but I'm asking, where do you want to go from here? What is your final plan? If you don't have a final plan, you're going to quickly find your movement co-opted, and to be honest, you have found your movement co-opted by people who have plans of their own, and chances are those plans have very little to do with what you are hoping for. If you're a listener who thinks, like Percy Blake Shelley, that Christianity is the most detestable of all religions, I invite you to give me a few reasons why Christianity is the most detestable of all religions, and a few reasons why atheism or your theology, your religion of choice, is superior. I'm happy to talk with people on these subjects. I am very, very happy to be educated on these subjects. If you dislike my take or I dislike yours, we are both free to agree to disagree and go our separate ways or to work on other pressing problems on which we might be able to join together for a solution. If I am right, and I have never in my life hoped more to be wrong, we are looking at an impending crash of the U.S. government fueled by the breaking of the petrodollar, fueled by the enormous economic toll of the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown, fueled by the divisions which have been stoked for 6 years by a mass media that seems intent on pitting working-class white people against everybody, by ongoing attacks on Christianity and Christians, by an ongoing toleration of violence, arson, and all in the name of peaceful dissent. I think we all know that things are going to get worse before they get better, and quite a few of us are even thinking they're going to get worse and may not get better. If we don't start building bridges now between our communities, if we can't see each other as fellow human beings rather than as skin colors or ideologies, then we are inevitably going to wind up at war with each other. And that's why I'm talking about the just war theory today. It's not because I'm planning for a war, although to be quite honest, I am planning for a war and I expect a war. I am trying to start these dialogues so that together we can avoid a war, or barring that we can keep the bloodshed, the atrocities, and the civilian casualties down to a bare minimum. I know that we are a divided nation. You just have to look out your window. You can see we're a divided nation. The longer this fighting goes on, the hotter this war gets, the deeper those divisions are going to be. I know we've got old grudges. If we don't find a peaceful way out of this, we're going to have new grudges on top of those old ones. And so if all of our efforts fail, if we can't come to a solution or to a dialogue and we find ourselves at war with each other, what sort of responses can you expect from us? Well, in 1425, a little French peasant girl, 13 years old, named Joan, had a vision of St. Michael, St. Catherine, and St. Margaret. They told her to drive the English from French territory and asked that she bring the Dauphin to Reims for his coronation. She waited while when she was 16, she asked her relative, Durand Lassois, to take her to Vaucouleurs, and she petitioned Robert de Baudricourt, the garrison commander, for permission to visit the French royal court in Chinon. Now, Baudricourt didn't take a 16-year-old French peasant girl very seriously, but she left, and the following January, she came back with the support of two of Baudricourt's soldiers, Jean de Metz and Bertrand de Poligny. De Metz said that Joan had told her, "I must be at the king's side. There will be no help if not for me. Though I would have rather remained spinning wool at my mother's side, yet I must go, and must I do this thing, for the Lord wills that I do so." And so Metz, who apparently was convinced that she was a girl who had seen visions, a lot of people became convinced over the coming months that Joan of Arc was indeed a visionary. Metz brings her back before Baudricourt, the garrison commander. She tells him there will be a military reversal at Rouvray, near Orleans. A few days later, a messenger got back to Baudricourt and said that Joan's prediction had come true. Now, Baudricourt started thinking about, well, that battle was several days away. There's no way this French maid could have seen that. And so Baudricourt decided, all right, this young lady has indeed had a divine revelation. Baudricourt secures her an admission to see Prince Charles at that time. She arrives, she's riding a horse that people donated to her, dressed in donated armor, carrying a donated sword. And at this point, what had been an Anglo-French conflict, one of many throughout history, had turned into a religious war on the part of the French. Charles, being a cautious fellow, was afraid that having a visionary link to their side could have him accused of witchcraft and sorcery. So the Dauphin ordered a theological exam at Poitiers. He ordered clergy to speak with Joan, had a commission of inquiry, what we call an inquisition, and in April 1429, they declared Joan to be of an irreproachable life, a good Christian, possessed of the virtues of humility, honesty, simplicity. They were not sure as to whether or not she was acting on the basis of divine inspiration, but they did say that there was a favorable presumption on the divine nature of her mission. To make sure and to provide a test, they suggested that we wait and see if her claim that she could lift the siege of Orléans, which she had predicted would happen, came true. And so she arrived at Orléans on April 29th, 1429. She was excluded from war councils, and she was kept ignorant of battles. During the 5 months before her arrival, the French had only attempted one assault on Orléans, and it had resulted in their defeat. On May 4th, the Armagnacs, the French troops, captured Saint-Loup. The next day, Fortress Saint-Jean-le-Blanc, which was deserted. The English approached the army to stop their advance. A French cavalry charge with Joan of Arc at their side was all it took to turn the English away without a fight. On June 7th, they attacked the English stronghold La Troelle. On May 7th, Joan took an arrow between her neck and her shoulder as she held her banner, but she returned after it was treated to encourage the final assault to take the fortress. And the next day, the English retreated from Orléans, and the siege was over. Joan went on to carry her banner for several other French victories until finally she was captured at Compiègne by English and Burgundian forces and taken prisoner. Joan was tried in 1431 before a secular English court, guised as an ecclesiastical court. The ecclesiastics who tried her were pro-English, mostly Burgundian. Joan had no right to a legal advisor and was found guilty of heresy after a show trial and infamously on burned at the stake in Rouen on May 30, 1431. At that burning, she was tied to a tall pillar at the Ville Marché, asked Father Martin Ladvenu and Father Isambard de la Pierre to hold a crucifix before her, and an English soldier made a small cross which she put in the front of her dress. After she died, the English raked the coals to expose her body so no one could spread rumors of her escaping alive, and then burned the body two more times to reduce it to ashes so no one could collect relics. After burning her body to ash, the English threw her remains in the Seine River, and the executioner, Geoffrey Thorage, said later he greatly feared to be damned. In 1456, 25 years later, the inquisitorial courts heard a posthumous appeal wherein they declared Joan innocent. 490 years later, Pope Benedict XV canonized her. What can we learn from this? Perhaps the first thing we can learn is just how effective a good visionary can be. Did she win the war for the French? She certainly inspired them to triumph in a few battles. Would they have triumphed without her? I couldn't say, but I can say that with her by their side, they certainly did triumph. One could note those soldiers fought an awful lot harder when they thought they were fighting with God on their side than they did when they thought that this was just one in an endless series of grubby land squabbles between kings. There are few things more terrifying than an army hopped up on religious fervor. Most of us have a healthy fear of dying. When you've got somebody who believes that should they die in battle, they will receive the glorious crown of martyrdom, you've got a pretty dangerous fighter on your hands. Everybody today thinks of Islam as the religion of suicide bombers, the religion of jihad. Once upon a time, Christians had a very similar war ethic. If you find a Christian mystic who starts inspiring Christian militias and tells them to fight back against the shadow, fight back against the enemy, you could be facing something you really don't want to face. The church militant's been sleeping for about 500 years now. It's been a while since we've seen crusades and mass religious violence on the part of or the organized church. You don't want to wake that dragon. You all keep poking that dragon with sharp sticks, and when he wakes up and roars, you all are going to get burned so badly. And no, I'm not telling you this to threaten you. If I may be forgiven for paraphrasing Full Metal Jacket, sir, this flawed sinner feels obligated to inform you that that dragon is large, has sharp teeth, and fiery breath. Sir, another thing we can learn about those Christian visionaries from the story of Joan of Arc is that it frequently doesn't go well for those missionaries. Joan gets burned at the stake. There's innumerable martyrs in the Christian tradition who died in the name of their faith. They sometimes died horribly. This would discourage most people from choosing these paths. Most of us want to lead a safe and a comfortable life. These people were more concerned with their immortal soul and more concerned with their duties to God and to Christ, and they were willing to sacrifice their lives and were willing to suffer for it. You know, in the case of Joan and many other warrior saints, they were even willing to lead battles to fight other people who were doing what they felt was sinful against the church, or in the case of Joan, against the French people. God commanded them, and they obeyed, and because they obeyed, they convinced a bunch of other people to follow them, and sometimes to achieve great things, even at the cost of their own lives. If we get an American Jeanne d'Arc, and I will note that during times of social and economic stress, you do tend to see a pronounced spike in religious fervor and in religious interest, and you also see a pronounced spike in interest in mystics and faith healers and such like, I think it's entirely possible you could see an American Joan of Arc, and if you do, she's likely to lead some pretty bloody charges. Now, what would be a proportionate response under a just war theory? Well, Christianity, like most traditions, recognizes a right to return fire. If somebody has shot at you, you have a right to shoot back. If somebody has thrown a punch at you, you have a right to punch back. Doxing has been, for several years, a favorite tactic of the left against anybody who went against any of their lines of doctrine. People have been canceled. People have lost jobs. It's not surprising to see that people on the right have returned the favor. Rose Alma, the girl who was punched by Nathan Domingo at a rally, the date of which escapes me at the moment, had her nudes sent to her family, posted all over the internet. I saw them. I was not the better for the experience. There have been leftists who've faced harassment after getting their names and pictures passed around on various right-wing forums. It is an appropriate response to harassment. If it's all right to dox somebody for saying all lives matter, it's all right to contact somebody's employer, somebody's school, somebody's family, somebody's neighbors, somebody's local churches or police departments, and let them know about their intention to harm monuments or buildings, to let them know about their degenerate behavior, to make them feel afraid the same way that tool was used against us to make us feel afraid. When you attack our monuments, when you attack our churches and threaten our parishioners, we have a right to retaliate. We have a right to seek out the people who organized the attacks on us and to show them that not only is it just not right to attack holy places or to attack people at worship, it's just not safe. King Louis IX of France, better known as St. Louis, once said that the best way to deal with a blasphemer was to run him through the bowels with your sword. We don't carry swords anymore, and we understand that there's a reason we tolerate freedom of speech. We went through the 30 Years' War. We went through a long period of quarrels after the Reformation, and we came to the conclusion that it's better to allow people to follow their conscience in matters of faith and to keep their discussions and debates rather than engaging in war with each other. Raised as an American Catholic, I was raised as a member of a religion that was not only a minority religion in America, and it still is a minority religion in America, though it is the largest Christian denomination now, I believe. I've got a vested interest in a society that tolerates freedom of worship. Because people regularly vandalize our crucifixes, saint statues, and Madonnas, I've got a vested interest in seeing that people don't desecrate mosques, synagogues, mandirs, or any other religious institutions. We have differences between us in theology. They are serious and very real differences. The fact that we recognize those differences in our theology and the fact that we consider those differences to be important means that by that fact alone, we have more in common with each other than we do with somebody who thinks those differences trivial and thinks both of our religions to be silly. There's a long-standing tradition of returning courtesy for courtesy and respect for respect. I'm happy to treat anybody's religious beliefs, anybody's ethnicity, anybody's heritage with the same respect they show for mine. I don't hate anybody who does not hate me. If you hate me for just cause, I will do what I can to rectify it. But if you hate me for reasons beyond my control, you have decided that you're my enemy and that you seek my destruction, I will defend myself against you. I will defend my family against you. I will defend my tradition, my heritage, and my church against you by any means necessary. I have no interest in genociding any group. Even if I weren't prohibited from doing so by my church, I have no interest in genocide anyway, for crying out loud. Even if I didn't have moral misgivings about it, it's not practical. We've been a multiracial country since our inception. There are 200 million people or so in the United States right now who identify as white. There are over 100 million people who identify as non-white. No group has the resources or the will to completely eradicate any other group. We are still all human beings, and we all recognize that. I expect, I've said this before, I expect an end result of the riots and protests is going to be greater segregation, not less segregation. I expect that we're going to see greater, not less, ethnic tensions and racial tensions. I expect more, not less, violence and ill feeling between us. Before this is all over, we're likely to see a few nasty group ethnic-based massacres on each side. I say that not because I'm celebrating it. I'm warning you of it. And once again, I really hope I'm wrong, but history suggests I'm not. But as I said before, the greater the violence, the greater the bloodshed, the bigger the new grudges we're going to throw on top of the old ones. We have no choice but to live together. We are going to self-segregate voluntarily. I suspect there will be a fair bit of involuntary segregation before this is all over. But we are going to need as many bridges as we can build between communities, between traditions, between people. I don't know if that's going to be enough. Maybe it won't be enough. It probably won't be enough. I have no illusions that I'm capable of changing history. But I do know this. I would rather go down in defeat for a good cause than I would triumph for a bad one. The Christian tradition is replete with stories of people who chose to die for a good cause rather than triumph for a bad one. As the Catechism says, martyrdom is the supreme witness given to the truth of the faith. It means bearing witness even unto death. The martyr bears witness to Christ who died and rose, to whom he is united by charity. He bears witness to the truth of the faith and of Christian doctrine. He endures death through an act of fortitude. Let me become the food of the beasts through whom it will be given me to reach God. The Church has painstakingly collected the records of those who persevered to the end in witnessing to their faith. These are the acts of the martyrs. The Catechism then goes on to quote St. Ignatius of Antioch, who died in the year 140. He's an early 2nd century martyr. Neither the pleasures of the world nor the kingdoms of this age will be of any use to me. It is better for me to die in order to unite myself to Christ Jesus than to reign over the ends of the earth. I seek him who died for us. I desire him who rose for us. My birth is approaching. I bless you for having judged me worthy from this day and this hour to be counted among your martyrs. You have kept your promise, God of faithfulness and truth. For this reason and for everything, I praise you, I bless you, I glorify you through the eternal and heavenly High Priest, Jesus Christ, your beloved Son. Through him who is with you in the Holy Spirit, may glory be given to you now and in the ages to come. Amen. When you begin attacking the churches, and during the COVID-19 lockdown, when you declared abortion clinics to be essential businesses while keeping churches closed, a fair number of evangelical Christians started getting the idea they were in the end times and the church was indeed under attack. Whether or not a war has been declared, if enough people think they're fighting in a war, they're going to fight in a war, and you got a war. Right now, a lot of Christians believe that Christianity is under attack. I'm pretty well plugged into the Tradcath scene. Through my friends Tom and Dana, I've gotten to know a lot of good people on the evangelical scene. There's been increasing talk of martyrdom and what that means, serious talk about dying for the faith. There's been a lot of people collecting guns and ammo who are getting ready to defend the faith. They are ready to kill for the faith. That's why I'm talking to you right now. Nobody here wants a war. Remember the whole boogaloo flap? Did you ever notice it turned into a booga dud? They might have caught a few people wearing Hawaiian shirts. They're mostly Second Amendment libertarian idiots of various political stripes, united only in their common stupidity for falling for a honeypot. The reason that didn't work is because the globalists totally misunderstood the dissident right. Because they want to rule the world and have a great economic and social empire, they assume that's what we want too. Most of the people on the dissident right don't want to take over the world. They just want to be left alone. You keep telling us we're horrible racists and white supremacists. As a Christian, I've said it before, every human life is sacred from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death. That includes black lives, white lives, Jewish lives, Muslim lives, Hindu lives. There is no exception to that. The church believes that homosexuality is a grievous sin. The church believes that boys have a penis and girls have a vagina, and that efforts to live contrary to that are contrary to God's law and biology. The church also believes that a homosexual's life or a transgender person's life is sacred. They believe the act of homosexual or the transgender person is living in sin, but they believe everybody is living in sin. We're all sinners. There was a flap a while back where Pope Francis had a charity which was feeding transgender prostitutes in Rome, and there was a brouhaha, how dare he, they're sinners. Well, any Christian charity that was set up only for people who don't sin would only have one person attending, two if it was set up by the Catholic or the Orthodox. While the church has always condemned homosexuality, they hated sodomites so much that they hired one to paint the Sistine Chapel. Look, I know lots of Protestants who believe that the Pope is the Antichrist and that our veneration of Mary is really worship to the whore of Babylon. I don't really like it very much, but you know what? So long as they leave us free to engage in our worship the way we see fit, I will happily extend the same courtesy to them. We don't all have to love each other to have a functioning society. We don't all have to provide each other with constant affirmations of how wonderful we are and how everything we're doing is just dandy. What we need to do is to tolerate each other. Not love each other, not like each other, not respect each other, tolerate each other. Give each other the space to live our lives as we see fit. Isn't that what the left's been promising us? Freedom for the individual to find his or her or zim or zare or there or whatever's fullest experience to the best of their abilities as a human being? Give us the space to live our individual experience, to form our chosen community, and we'll give you the same space. We think that your lifestyle choices are wrong, sinful, and will ultimately lead to your physical and spiritual harm. You disagree with us and think that our spiritual position is silly and repressive and is causing us all kinds of frustration and leads to us becoming bigots. Tell you what, how about we agree to disagree? We know where we stand with each other. We know each other's position. If a gay person wants to come to Christ and live a chaste life, there are many people, many organizations who will help him do that. Why would you be concerned that an adult made a decision regarding his or her or their sexuality and how they viewed that sexuality. I mean, if a gay person suddenly declared him or herself asexual, you'd give him a flag, pins, and identity, affinity groups. Why are you so worried that a gay person might suddenly find Christianity? I know there are Christian churches who welcome LGBT people, or even congregations specifically for LGBT people. In my experience, they tend to focus a little more on the queerness than on the Christianity, but if that's somebody's way toward the truth, you know, again, as J.R.R. Tolkien said, anybody who goes searching for the truth, in however halting a way, is sails toward the true harbor, is likely to catch at least a glimpse of it. And again, my opinion of the theology of these churches is irrelevant. So long as they give me and my family and my house, you know, my church, the right to practice our religion as we see fit, to withhold communion to those who do not meet our standards, and active homosexuals in many congregations would be denied communion because that is considered a sinful lifestyle. That may be very hurtful for a gay person, but the gay person has the right to go to another congregation, another religious tradition, which better suits his or her needs. Freedom of religion means the right to set standards of behavior for your religion, just like freedom of association gives you the right to choose whom you wish to associate or not associate with. Anything else is just the freedom to do whatever someone else allows you to do. And because I asked my listeners who supported BLM, Antifa, and similar movements what their vision of an ideal world was, maybe I should talk a little bit about my vision. To do that, I'm going to start with a quote from an article written by the Catholic science fiction and fantasy writer Gene Wolfe. He wrote the books The New Sun, absolutely fantastic. I got to thank my pal Matt Grossman for introducing me to Gene Wolfe. You absolutely have to read this guy. But anyway, his article, The Best Introduction to the Mountains, is probably the best piece on J.R.R. Tolkien I've ever read, and it opens with, "There is one very real sense in which the Dark Ages were the brightest of times, and that is this, that they were times of defined and definite duties and freedoms. The king might rule badly, but everyone agreed as to what good rule was. Not only every earl and baron, but every carl and churl knew what an ideal king would say and do. The peasant might behave badly, but the peasant did not expect praise for it, even his own praise. These assertions could be quibbled over endlessly, of course. There are always exceptional persons and exceptional circumstances. Nevertheless, they represent a broad truth about Christianized barbarian society as a whole, and articles that focus on exceptions provide a picture that is fundamentally false, even when the instances on which they are based are real and honestly presented. At a time when few others knew this, and very few others understood its implications, J.R.R. Tolkien both knew and understood, and was able to express that understanding in art, and in time, in great art." And I think that's something we've lost in modern society. We've particularly lost it over the past 5 to 10 years, this sense of knowing your place in society, knowing your purpose in life, knowing what was expected of you, and striving to live up to those expectations, you know, feeling bad when you didn't live up to those expectations, and feeling good when you did. And yes, you know, as Gene Wolfe noted, some people found that constraining. It was by no means a perfect system. Christians understood, as Plato did before them, that this is a flawed and corrupt world which is a reflection of the ideal, and as such will always be a flawed reflection. But the people living under that system knew who they were, and that's something we've lost. They were happier for that knowledge than we are for our ignorance of who we are. We have to strive to create an endless myriad of identities that we can live to show our true self. Those people knew their true self. Their lives had meaning. Their triumphs had meaning. Their defeats had meaning. Their joy had meaning. And their suffering had meaning. Can we say that today? And Gene Wolfe's second paragraph sheds a lot of insight into why I've been looking back to the past so strongly. He says, as a child, I had been taught a code of conduct. I was to be courteous and considerate. And most courteous and most considerate of those less strong than I, of girls and women, and of old people especially. Less educated men might hold inferior positions, but that did not mean that they themselves were inferior. They might be, and often would be, wiser, braver, and more honest than I was. They were entitled to respect and were to be thanked when they befriended me, even in minor matters. Legitimate authority was to be obeyed without shirking and without question. Mere strength, the corrupt coercion Washington calls power, and Chicago, clout, was to be defied. It might be better to be a slave than to die, but it was better to die than to be a slave who acquiesced in his own slavery. Above all, I was to be honest with everyone. Debts were to be paid, and my word was to be as good as I could make it. And I happen to believe that is a perfectly fine code of conduct. Wolfe saw that in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. I've seen something like that in the Grail Legends. That's something I've been exploring a great deal lately. I believe that our world has fallen under a shadow. Tolkien saw that shadow. He called it Morgoth and he called it Sauron. We are living under that shadow. That shadow has taken control. Sauron only had one eye. The shadow we fight has a billion eyes that watch us all the time and gathers our data. The shadow has an army of Grima worm tongues shouting lies and insisting their truths, goading our mobs with buzzwords like spearmen leading herds off a cliff. They tell us what their master wants us to hear, and they malign anyone who might expose their treachery. Some of us have been targeted by them, and, you know, if you join our cause, you may find yourself in their sights. If you're listening to this, you've probably seen through many of the shadow's lies, and now you think you're immune to those lies, but you're not. The shadow shapes the futures you want, you see. It created the world you live in, and the world from which you imagine all other possible worlds. The Dark Lord has shaped your choices. You may think if you elect a new Dark Lord who supports your favorite causes, puts the last Dark Lord's advisors in prison, everything will be better. You know, you may want to take control of the system which oppresses us, turn it into one which better suits your ideas of justice. You may even want to throw your hands up in despair, but all of those act in the shadow's service. There are a whole bunch of ways by which Mordor can expand its borders. And yet, this sounds hopeless. Any quest worth going on appears hopeless. Our ancestors knew about human frailty. The Christ myth tells us about our frailty, it tells us about our sinfulness, but it also tells us about our capacity for redemption. Tolkien showed us a couple of terrifying portraits of the shadow in Sauron and Morgoth. He also showed us one of our opponent's blind spots. Remember, Mordor's got a hidden passage through which the bravest and most desperate find a way to victory. So where does that leave us? Well, we're a ragtag collection of misfits, mad dreamers, and mystics, along with several tortoises and a few snakes, and many lovely friends. We don't have a lot of armor, we don't have a lot of weapons, we don't know the way to Mount Doom, we don't know where the Grail is located, we don't know what monsters guard it, we're not even entirely sure what it looks like. All we've got is the cross and our king. We know some have triumphed under the cross. We also know many, many more have been martyred beneath it. If you follow this cross, you may lose your friends, your family, your career. You may even lose your life. You're definitely going to lose yourself. We're fighting against overwhelming odds. We're outmatched in numbers and strength. And most of our wisdom is going to quickly be dismissed as foolishness. Now, you've been told our world floats in a vast emptiness, and all those lights sparkling in our night sky are just icy rocks and flaming balls of gas. Our ancestors talked about a creator who hung those lanterns, and he permeates every centimeter of that great void. Your teachers told you that universe is so big it cannot have been created. We've looked out at those expanses like our ancestors did. We've seen what can only be a great creation. Where you've been told there are only blind mechanical forces, we've seen a divine purpose. We don't understand that purpose. We can't understand that purpose, but we have seen it. That purpose lies in the knowledge of good and evil we carry in our hearts, that you carry in your heart, and the certainty that the forces we stand against are evil. You felt that great spreading shadow, and I'm sure you doubt our cause. Sometimes we doubt our cause. Chroniclers didn't tell you this, but the Grail Knights spent a whole bunch of their journeys lamenting their itchy armor, wondering why they ever agreed to go wandering about for a magic chalice. It's not going to be easy. Nothing worth doing is ever easy. But we're going to create our own story. It's yet to be told. We don't know whether it's going to end in triumph or martyrdom, but it can only begin when we take that first fumbling leap toward a pale reflection of somebody else's dimly seen glimpse of the light.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, this has been Kenaz Phylon. Thank you for listening to the 6th episode of Notes from the End of Time, and may God bless us each and every one.